here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stoned, immaculate.
Hello and welcome. This is the C86 show. I'm David Eastall. As you know, we love a special guest. This week is going to be the turn of the musician, singer, songwriter, guitarist, and also author and artist as well. It's the one and only Luke Haynes, who I spoke to very recently to find out more about life, love, poetry, and all that other groovy stuff. Was in The Servants back in the 80s, also various other combos during the Britpop period, The Auteurs, Black Box Recorder, has a solo career and has collaborated with Peter Buck on various albums, which I believe there's two and a third one coming. But has written several fantastic books, well, actually quite a few, including Bad Vibes, Britpop and My Part in Its Downfall. But there's a new one that has just come out, March 2024, titled Freaks Out, Weirdos, Misfits and Deviants, The Rise and Fall of Righteous Rock and Roll. This has come out on 9/8 Books, so available from all good bookshop and also online. I will give you the link in the notes below. But anyway, this is the interview. So after several minutes of interesting but slightly casual chat, we get down to the exciting subject that was really talking about when he thought about putting this book together.
I've been toying with it for a while, and then a publisher, Pete Selby from 9/8 Books, sort of persuaded me to write a book. And I was a bit reticent because I'd having written two books before, I know how long it takes, and you know, books can kind of be, they can kind of fall by the wayside and be a bit ignored, that kind of thing. I kind of gave him a synopsis or a proposal or whatever they call it these days, of what I wanted to do, and he was really into it. So we just took it from there, and it's quite easy, really. But as, like I say, it's sort of an idea that I've been knocking around for a few, drinking wine this evening, that I've been knocking around for a while, really since after the second book, Post Everything. But at that time, I'd proposed a few ideas to various publishers, but no one was really taking, no one was biting or whatever. Now music books seem more popular than they once were. So
And 9/8 Books seem, or publishers seem to be the go-to publishing company. Yeah. It used to be Faber and Faber and Omnibus, but now everyone's looking for the quality that is 9/8 Books, really, isn't it? They've got a good little roster at the moment, and they're on a good roll, actually. And did you find the writing process quite cathartic, as in being able to sort of bring up some things? Just kind of processing your own life as well. Was that quite an enjoyable experience?
It wasn't an unenjoyable experience. It was a pretty enjoyable book to write. I think when you're writing a music book, it has to kind of sound like the author is having fun. Otherwise, I think you can get into terribly dry prose about music, and that's always my bête noir, is very dry music books, and sort of rock history. I don't really like rock history. I think it's a bore, and I think I think rock books should be kind of a bit like listening to a cool record. You know, it should be about reading a cool book.
Yes, absolutely. And did you have, I mean, obviously from your experience and life in music, was it quite straightforward who you had in mind of the people that were cool and those who were or freaks and those who were definitely not freaks? Was this something that was been on your mind for a long time?
I think it's always on my mind. But you kind of, when you get into your 50s, like your middle 50s, that I now heroically am in, you kind of come to, you, I think you're either kind of quite comfortable in your own skin, or you're having some kind of breakdown. I think I'm the former. So I think it was a good chance at this age to write about, I suppose, the records that kind of made me, really, and my attitude towards rock and roll music. And I use, as I say in the book, I use the term rock and roll as a very general term. Rock and roll kind of means everything from, in my world, from kind of heretic sects and secret cults to the pop music that I like, and to then real rock and roll like Gene Vincent, or, you know, even like, you know, freak rock like Hawkwind or Pink Fairies.
Yes, because during lockdown, I remember people got a bit bored, didn't they, after a while, and started putting their list of 20 favourite artists or 20 favourite gigs, and everyone needed to appear to be cool and hip. But then they were quite predictable in the sense that they'd always have things like Captain Beefheart, Frank Zappa, King Crimson, and bands. And after reading the first five of most people's lists, you thought, that's just really tedious and a bit self-conscious.
It's the canon, isn't it? The rock canon, which is a bit... This is a bit boring. I mean, some of it certainly kind of, you know, I mean, a lot of it deserves its place. It's great and all that, you know. But some of the great albums that we all, you know, recognise as great are great, and there's no getting away from it. But I don't think you necessarily need to write about them all the time or think about them all the time. There are other things out there. So that's kind of what I mean. And in the book, I do a kind of, there's a kind of rambling, hopefully kind of comedic bit. I think it might be a chapter or half a chapter or so about what actually coolness and what it is and what is cool and uncool. And when you're cool, you become uncool. And when you become uncool, there's certain types of uncool that are cool. And it's very, very tricky, you know. I don't think there's any kind of right or wrong to it. But these are the things you have to kind of take on board when you've spent your life basically making rock and roll records.
Yes, but there's definitely, you had a sort of a thing about shorts, didn't you? People who wear shorts are definitely not freaks.
Sorry, I just snorted a load of wine at my nose.
that does kind of make sense. I love there's a bit about Prince, saying that people who like Prince, you know, had good careers and steady finance, and obviously weren't really into music. And then there's this little bit about people who can wear shorts and the enabler, which is Tony Wilson, which I thought was quite funny.
He was a shorts enabler. Yes, yeah. There's a glossary of
was that worse than being a person who wore shorts, though?
Shorts enabler. I'm not sure about this. I mean, it's a very, I don't know if, I can't remember if I put the story in the book, but there's a very funny, Malcolm Ross, who was a member of Orange Juice a long time ago, the great guitarist from Joseph K, Malcolm Ross, and he played in my Bader Meinhof band for a little bit. He told me a very funny story about the first time that they went on Top of the Pops, that Edwyn Collins insisted that they all wore shorts, and Malcolm, still to this day, still very unhappy about that.
Yeah, because you just wouldn't have imagined Hendrix or, you know, Jim Morrison in shorts, would you?
Brian
and you wouldn't
Jones,
want to.
You know?
No, it would have been none of those. Or, no. You know, yeah. And then when you saw Elvis in films with shorts, it wasn't going to be good, was it? It was
No. Well, I mean, no, I'm the only person who's I think there are the only two people who've ever been able to wear shorts successfully are Lemmy, who wore very, very, very seriously short shorts, which are fairly horrible, and Philip Larkin, who has an unbelievably good pair of legs. So,
I never thought of the legs, but then he had a little bit of a lean into
Larkin's legs.
But he had a lean into the right, which always makes you think of the Nazi youth, which are big on shorts, aren't they?
Are you saying that in regards to his politics or his shorts?
I don't know. Could you have Nazi shorts? You could do, probably, couldn't you?
Well, I think if they're available, then maybe Lemmy and Philip Larkin would have worn them.
I think Lemmy's weren't they denim though? I think his were denim shorts.
I think they were kind of cut off, weren't they? But they were cut off very, very, very short. Yes. Yeah.
Yes, because one band that was fascinating, which I go to every 5 years because I think I should like them, is the Incredible String Band that you managed to embrace quite easily. I've even done an interview with Rose to try and get through this because she did a book a few years ago. And it's still tricky, isn't it? But you do bring in Scientology, which is quite interesting as well, because I think that's what sort of, she said, split the band up for her.
It certainly changed the band. I mean, there's a kind of school of thought that their kind of peak period, and it's again this is kind of getting canonical, you know, that the classic period was pre-Scientology, but the records after Scientology, there's a couple of really good ones. They do have sort of various kind of there's various kind of Scientology lyrics, which I don't mind that. I mean, I can, you know, I'm broad-minded enough to listen to lyrics about most things. It doesn't really bother me. Obviously, I'm not going to join up the church or anything like that. But they are quite, they can be quite quite tough to get into, this string band.
Yes, well, they are, but at the same time, one feels, every few years, it's nice to dip your toe in and just in embrace it as well, really. Because the other band, because it's interesting during the 80s, because you bring in the Job Seekers Allowance, don't you, Enterprise Allowance Scheme, as an important part of our sort of cultural and sort of the musical awakening of the 80s, especially on the indie scene and all the bands that people like John Peel played. So that was quite a critical bit for the sort of freaks, really, wasn't it? Because it gave people the 5 years of being able to just mess about.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of making an argument in the book that might have been the sort of like the last sort of great freak period. Because it was a sort of, it was a kind of very much, a generation of will be unemployed and to hell with it people that certainly was part of my generation, that everyone was on the dole. I mean, I still know a lot of these people, you know, and they're still in bands, and they were always, you know, they were, you know, of that generation. And in many ways, the dole was, we kind of saw it as an arts grant, really, you know, had no intention to work, and you know, and these are very unfashionable things to say probably now, but you know, Thatcher certainly kind of instilled that in a lot of my generation, that, you know, if this awful woman is telling us to you know, to get off the dole, then we're damn well going to stay on the dole, and we're going to make our jangly records. You know?
Yes. Well, it felt like one was bringing down society by being on the dole.
By jangly C86 records. Yeah.
Yes. And we were going to bleed the country dry with our £30, £40 dole money every fortnight. Yeah. But it made absolutely no difference at all. But at the same time, it did allow a certain freedom of not sort of having that ambition to think that one had a future.
When I first started making records, I didn't really ever consider that, you know, that maybe 5 or 6 years later I would be on a major label with the Auteurs, and then on that major label for about 10 years or something ridiculous like that. It never occurred to me, because you were just sort of making records because you wanted to make records that sounded a bit like Pale Blue Eyes by the Velvet Underground. Something like that, you know? And if you aspired to anything, it was probably to be, you know, as big as Joseph K or something, you know.
Yes, but then your dream was broken, isn't it, in the 90s in Glastonbury Festival when you see the Velvets sort of performing. And I do remember, because I that was a very hot Glastonbury that year, and I remember getting, there was a lot of dust, and I suddenly got this problem with my eye, so I had to find the medical tent and walked slightly staggered round by the pyramid stage, went, that's that famous band, but I can't see out of one eye, so I'll keep wondering.
I wish I'd had a problem with my eyes and I wouldn't have seen it. And even if I had a problem with my ears, it would have been better, then I wouldn't have seen it or heard it. But sad, alas, I did.
Yes, that was true. Because you obviously was not married, but you were very closely connected to the Servants at this stage, weren't you, in the 80s? Well, before.
At the end of 86 on until 1990, I think. Yeah.
Right. And this is with David Westgate, who then
Westgate,
has this,
Westgate, yeah.
Yes, who brings out this amazing record with members of the Triffids and the Go-Betweens, and that features in the book as well, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah. That was the first record. It was the first proper record I played on. I mean, it was the first record I played on, proper or not. But it was a proper record, yeah.
Yes.
And it was a creation, and it was, yeah, it was with LZ McDonald and Martin Casey, now the Bad Seeds, with the rhythm section. And I was a callow, wispy 19-year-old.
Which must have been an amazing experience, because one thing I noticed doing all these interviews with bands from that period, especially the Australian, New Zealand ones, is that they all would have this great adventure. We thought it was just amazing just to go, I don't know, to the Dog and Duck to see an indie band on a Wednesday night, but they actually travelled to the other side of the planet to squat in London to form bands or form a band and to try and make it in Britain, then Europe, which was quite amazing actually when you think about the kind of, I don't know, sense of sort of adventure in their little souls.
Well, yeah, and I didn't, at the time, even though I knew a lot of these people. I mean, like I said, I didn't really know the Triffids, but I worked with, as I said, Alzi and Martin. But I knew, as the time in the circle, I got to know the Go-Betweens quite well. I knew Robert and Grant. I still know Robert's still a friend, Robert Forster. And I knew Lindy a little bit from the Go-Betweens. I knew Peter Walsh from the Apartments. And we thought they were kind of, myself and David West, like, we kind of thought they were kind of really successful stars. We didn't really equate the fact that they were, you know, really not making money or having hit records with the fact that, you know, with any kind of, you know, any reality, any kind of poverty or that. They were just sort of kind of what we wanted to be or what we aspired to. And it didn't really matter. They were living in squats and they were kind of sharing a place with a birthday party or whatnot, you know. And they weren't, you know, it wasn't, you know, they were kind of always in very precarious positions with their record labels. The Go-Betweens are always changing record labels. But we didn't really see it like that. It just seemed like people were benefactors to them, and that's kind of how it was in the 80s. You just had a benefactor to put out a record. You were putting out, you know, maybe like a couple of thousand copies of a record. It's a bit like now, actually, you know, where the music industry's changed so much. So it was, it was a formative and very different time.
Yes,
it was kind of the same as now. Yeah.
And there was a band who was around that period who only brought out a record recently, I think on Optic Nerve, called The Hangman's Beautiful Daughters, who hung out
I believe that's Sandy Fleming, photographer.
Yes, and I think she's taken a fantastic picture of Robert with, I think, a hole in his shoe during that period, because I think she seemed to sort of have sort of got to know him quite well during that period. So, yes, the thing that we all thought, you know, they were all very financially successful and would be retiring very soon to a mansion in sort of Cork or somewhere in Southern Ireland next to Enya was quite quite off the mark, really, at that stage.
No, I think they were just I don't know if they were able to draw the dole at that point. I don't know, because they were Australian, but I think they were all kind of pretty much living in penury.
Yes, there you go. Have you tried his muesli?
Robert's muesli. Not as yet. No, but Robert's always sort of had one eye on the kind of healthy breakfast cereal market.
Yes, well, it's a good market to get into, really, in later life.
That kind of guy,
So going back to your childhood and the 70s period, you mentioned two very important people in your life. There's Stephen Peregrine-Took, isn't there? And also
Steve Peregrine-Took, yeah.
And also Robert Calvert from Hawkwind as well. So were you aware of them during that period, or was it later on that you sort of got to...
No, later. I mean, I only really got into kind of Mark Bolan in about 1980. And obviously, he'd been dead 3 years at that point. And I'm still a massive Bolan fan, but I always, as I, you know, throughout the years, I always found it kind of interesting that Steve Peregrine took kind of got waylaid, you know, certainly in the, in, you know, in terms of that rock history, and but also as a person in many respects. And I just, he was just one of those people that kind of like, what happened to this guy? And it's a kind of, it's a fairly tragic story, I guess. There's a bit in the book where I'm talking about me kind of buying a double album of two Tyrannosaurus Rex records.
These are the kind of 60s whispery poetry ones, aren't they?
They're the ones I really like, the Tyrannosaurus Rex things. I mean, as much as I love Electric Warrior and The Slider, and actually everything by Mark, but I have a real kind of I think the Tyrannosaurus Rex ones are brilliant records. They're really weird, and they're like nothing real. They're a bit like the Incredible String Band, I suppose. I think that's what Mark Bolan was going for, but they kind of he was getting more Blakean. Whether Mark had ever read Blake, I kind of doubt it in some ways. Whether he read anything, I don't know. I mean, he was very dyslexic, that's for sure. But he just sort of made it all up as he went along, which is great.
Yes.
And Steve Peregrine was sacked, I think, when he was like 20, after three albums with Bolan. And then Bolan went on to huge success, and Took was replaced by Mickey Finn, who was much more kind of amenable and did what Mark Bolan told him to, and was not particularly a great musician, as Steve Took was. And Steve Took just sort of languished in the kind of drug scene of Ladbroke Grove until he sort of died, I suppose, predictably in 1980. But he died of an overdose of he choked on a cocktail cherry, apparently, after going on an opium kind of bender. When he received a royalty check from the Tyrannosaurus Rex albums. I wonder if those royalties were part of, you know, the likes of me buying those cheap reissues, they've provided him with that one royalty check where he finally got to kind of get into oblivion one last time.
Yes, it's got a kind of, but also at the same time, it's kind of an interesting story because there is this whole world of the Pink Fairies and obviously Mick Farren and the White Panthers. And I remember seeing this brilliant film about the Isle of Wight festival and Farren's there sort of wanting to charge the fences. And there he was on some sort of chat show sort of program, standing up, pointing and looked very formidable.
That's the David Frost versus Yippies thing, where the likes of Jerry Rubin comes over from America, and you've got the Oz people, Oz magazine people, and there's lots of, it's great. Yeah, there's lots of as you say, standing up and pointing and shouting the odds. And I think Jerry Rubin rolls up a joint or something at the end of it and smokes it, sitting on the chair.
Yes, it does have a good. It does have a moment. There's good pointing goes on with that. And then, so when did you discover your Hawkwind? Was this one? Were you one of those teenagers who first gig was seeing Hawkwind and you saw Stacey and went, oh my god?
It was much later for me. I mean, I had, this is the thing, and this is why I kind of write about them, that they were always a thing when I was about 15 or 16. You know, I'm really into gigs and into music. I've even got a band at that point. And lots of people, I kind of knew, older guys that I knew, because there's always older guys. I was very young. You'd kind of go around their house and they'd be playing like Hawkwind, Space Ritual, and Gong, you know, A Floating Anarchy gone with Here and Now and all that kind of stuff. And at the time, I just thought this was like really lousy hippie music. But you know, as I got older, I've come to appreciate it much more. But yeah, I kind of got that one wrong because I thought it was, this was kind of like, oh, this is like really weak shit, you know, weak hippie shit. Yeah, I'm a confirmed Hawkwind fan now.
And Robert Calvert.
And of course, Bob Calvert, yeah. When that's my, the Calvert period of Hawkwind is probably my favourite period.
Yes. So when you, after the 80s, the Thatcher years, we go into John Major, the 90s, your sort of record sales and everything, you sort of almost ride in the zeitgeist at this stage, aren't you? But it's quite interesting because it's running parallel to the world that is the Loaded magazine and James Brown. Mm. You mention quite savagely in this book, actually, don't you, Mr. Brown? And
I can't remember what to say, but I mean, I'm always going to go to James Brown. He deserves it. He's fine, you know. I mean, I see James Brown around, he wouldn't care, you know, but... It's I think he was, you know, responsible for, or he rode the zeitgeist and rode it in a very, very bad way and introduced the world, or Britain at least, into the Loaded magazine, which I think was a terrible thing. And you know, Loaded magazine, I'm sure, as I've said in the book, I think that the whole kind of Cool Britannia thing had played a large part in Brexit, you know, with all the kind of Union Jacks and all that kind of rubbish. I think that, you know, a lot of, young kids at that point, you know, subconsciously remember all these Union Jacks, and now come 2016, wherever the vote was, you know, they ticked leave.
Yes, they did. They were sort of going back to the good old days of the world. But I'm pleased because one of the, you know, obviously the people I grew up loving at the time was Gary Glitter. So he gets a nice little mention in here as well with his...
With a few caveats, yes. Yeah. The caveat being he was obviously a thoroughly awful man. But I think that, you know, the Glitter Band, it's more the Glitter Band get the kudos, I think. You know, I do recommend, you know, that you do, you know, I don't know if singles, 7-inch singles, I don't know if they're expensive in charity shops anymore, because I don't really buy 7-inch singles. I've got a lot of them, and I don't need any more. But I remember I used to be able to get all the Bell Records singles for about 5p in charity shops. I'm sure the Gary Glitter ones still, if charity shops even take them, I don't know.
They're
well worth your 5p, and you can be safe in the knowledge that the money goes to charity rather than Gary Glitter's pocket. So,
well, absolutely. But I always felt a bit sad for his, unlike, you know, a lot of people, you know, who've been about the band. The Cherry Red Records even brought out a greatest hit to the Glitter Band.
The Glitter Band, yeah, of course, yeah. And the Glitter Band were much better than, you know, than to be. I mean, they were inevitably kind of, defamed somewhat by the association, but it was nothing to do with them. Obviously, they're not. They were just the Glitter Band. They made some great records on their own.
Yes. So as we come to the end, and there's something that kind of has come up very recently, which I find very uncomfortable about life. Old men my age going on about the Glastonbury lineup and saying, God, it's just pop music. It's just a children's party. But sort of thinking people are sort of missing the point that it's always been about for the pop kids, you know, who just finished their O-levels and A-levels. And so you talk about Billie Eilish and also a bit about Taylor Swift. So what's your sort of, how do you cope with this kind of people throwing their little sort of opinions about what pop music is now and what people are listening to?
It's not for them. It's not, I mean, you know, if the Glastonbury Festival wants, a load of kind of, modern pop kids, that's as it should be. I mean, I don't, you know, it's not for me. In a way, I've had my time. And I'm just doing my thing on the periphery, really. And I think, you know, I don't like the moaning about I tried not to do moaning about modern music in the book because I don't think it's my business. I have young kids myself. I'm certainly not going to moan at them about what they listen to. I don't like all that. And I find it distasteful as much as I also find it distasteful. You know, when older journalists kind of start championing young bands as well, I kind of think just leave them alone. You know, let the young people have them. You know, just go away, go and do something. You know, go and do something. You know, at your age, sunshine.
Yes. Because we can remember being at gigs going, oh, who's that old perv at the gig?
And it's not great. I mean, you know, I don't go and see whoever the new band of the day. I don't bother go and see them. I mean, you know, good luck to them and all that, but I don't want to be like the oldest person in the venue. It's embarrassing. It's a bit creepy.
It's very creepy. So look, just explain your last two chapters in the book, 50 Dead. Taylor Swift's, which is referencing a lot about Neil Young. Just explain a little bit more about this one.
Well, I mean, that's a sort of, I suppose it's a bit of a satire on the kind of heritage rock kind of idea. It goes into the future. So I kind of fast forward to 2050 or something like that. I can't remember, maybe 2040.
44.
Yeah, for 2040, there you go. So Taylor Swift would be about probably in her sort of like about 50 at this point. It's very loose. I'm playing very fast and loose with the fact. It's a kind of fantasy thing. And I'm kind of working on the premise that Neil Young would still be alive. And I hope he is. It's just this sort of, it's just this idea of AI. I wrote it really because there's a lot of stuff about AI going on. And there still is about AI being this big kind of fearful thing. And I'm really kind of writing about what I'm really getting at is this kind of thing that's always been this sort of in the, you know, we don't need to worry too much about the threat of everything. Because I remember, as no doubt you do, you know, Tomorrow's World with Raymond Baxter, when he'd be talking about synthesizers are going to replace all instruments and all this kind of thing. So I just sort of wrote this fantasy thing about, 50 AI, Taylor Swift's going on tour. Unfortunately, the planes that the AI Taylor Swifts are in all kind of have terrible accidents and all crash. And Neil Young misunderstands this while watching it in his high tech barn, and decides to get Crazy Horse back together one more time with Frank Poncho, and they kind of go around the world. They go around the world in an attempt to save rock and roll, but Neil's so. Oh, he's forgotten. My, hey, hey. It goes on like this. I won't tell you the ending. Like, there is an ending to it. It's an actual, almost a short story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. I don't know if you're a spoiler.
Excellent. Yes, because actually there was another really funny chapter about the Jerry Garcia and Tony Morley. So what's
Paul
your...
Paul Morley.
Oh, yeah, Tony was a football player.
Tony
wasn't
Wilson.
He?
You're getting confused with your Wilsons and your Morleys here.
This is true, actually. I think he played for Aston Villa. Yeah, so how did this the greatest photograph of the 20th century, was this... Yes, how did this chapter come about?
Well, it's a friend of mine, Jeremy Deller, the artist, often makes a claim, a not unreasonable claim, that there's a photograph of Adrian Street, the wrestler, in 1973, I think it is, in Adrian was a sort of glam rock wrestler.
He looked like a member of Sweet, didn't he?
Yes, yeah, he looked very much like Brian Connolly on Sweet. And he's in a kind of silver outfit, pouting, wearing a lot of makeup with his sort of like long platinum hair, pictured in a mine shaft with his father, his coal miner father, and his father's coal miner co-workers looking on. They're kind of looking on very confused, and Jeremy makes the kind of as I said, not invalid point that this is the greatest photograph of the 20th century. It's a photograph that one of my bands, Black Box Recorder, used on their England Made Me album, and I think Jeremy saw it then, and he's then since used it in various things. I kind of contend that it's not the greatest photograph of the 20th century. The greatest photograph of the 20th century is a photograph of Paul Morley and Jerry Garcia. And it's the point when Paul Morley is that very kind of hip young gunslinger. And he's looking very kind of snidely at the camera, you know, kind of doing a kind of a mock kind of peace sign, as is Jerry. But Jerry's looking kind of like just a kind of genial hippie. And I think that's a kind of very interesting photograph, because it's about the sort of, you know, how the kind of music press positioned themselves as, you know, the enemy of all hippies and all this kind of thing. But really, it was the other way around, you know. The music press, the actual squares in this situation. And they were conformists, and Jerry had long been a non-conformist, regardless of his music. I mean, in the book, I list, you know, there's a lot of kind of stuff about, you know, very kind of autodidactic stuff from me about, you know, which Grateful Dead albums are good and which ones you shouldn't listen to. And I kind of list about six, which is not that many, given the huge catalogue of the ones you should listen to. So it's kind of it's about that, really. It's all very, the whole book is kind of based on, it's very kind of attitude book, you know, it's about attitude.
Yes. But then you bring in one of the great, you know, bands of the 80s, Dollar, don't you, as well? Which is quite a surprise, actually, because not many people, but I did an interview with Teresa. Is it Teresa? Other? Yes, just because she was doing a bit of she was coming over and doing this tour in the autumn. And she explained that she was the reason why Trevor Horn, you know, started his work as a producer, because she'd sort of begged, you know, after hearing Buggles, said, look, you know, could you do it? And he said, well, I'm not really a producer, but she sort of pestered him. And then suddenly he becomes the soundtrack of the 80s, really, doesn't he? So,
it's kind of me making some sort of like tangential kind of, you know, connections. But that also links up with Paul Morley. It's just about, you know, you can also, we get into like Jay McDonald, who presents Cruising. And we get into this idea of, you know, old people going on cruises. You know, they're seeing Jay McDonald. They regard her kind of as a freak. And it's like, where are the, you know, the freaks are everywhere, really. I mean, you know, we don't know. I mean, hey.
It's good. Did you, I mean, I know you might kind of roll your eyes at this, but there's mostly men, aren't there? You didn't sort of include many women in this.
I include the Manson girls.
The Manson.
I thought that was quite good. I mean,
yes, this is true.
I was very aware of that, it was like I said, it's not a rock history. It's kind of about the music that I kind of grew up with. It's from a very personal point of view, and it's most definitely not a history of freakdom or anything like that. I didn't want to do, the last thing I want to do is ever write any kind of rock history at all. It has to be come from a personal point of view and my recollection. So I didn't really want to kind of, you know, kind of cop out and kind of and add sort of like tokenistic female artists. I mean, I could have done, but that wasn't stuff that I was listening to. But the stuff I kind of had a long think about it, and it was that, well, the stuff, you know, one of the great albums, one of the absolutely great freak albums, and maybe one of the great albums, is the Manson Girls Family Jam album. It's like, well, hey, you know, we've got to go there, you know. And this was, I mean, and they rehearsed a lot. They were good. They'd done a lot of singing. It's very spooky. It's a very spooky record. They were bad ladies. I know that.
You wouldn't trust them with your feeding your cat when you're away, would you?
I'm going to say you wouldn't. Yeah, yeah. Which member of the Manson family would you regard? Would you leave your cat with?
Yes. Well, I think that's why. Because there was That's why I could never get Radiohead, because when they sung those lyrics, you thought, well, actually, if you were my neighbour, I'd still trust you to water the plants and look after the cat. Whereas some people, you would just think, I would move quite quickly. And so I couldn't genuinely get into the people like you know, like Radiohead, because it's like, clearly you're not creeps, are you? I might have been taking that too literally.
It's a good point. I mean, I think that, you know, a really, really good pop stars, you don't want to leave the cat with them.
Or the till. And I do remember Neil Young talking about, you know, dear old Charlie Manson, because he wanted to be a folk singer, didn't he? And he's got his records out there on Spotify, bizarrely, I think. And you can listen to
Charlie,
them.
Yeah, probably.
Charlie.
Yeah. And that's weird. I don't know. Who knows?
I know. And but it was quite interesting because Neil said one of those things when he was saying he kept getting rejected. And then Neil, in his the way he delivered it, said, yeah, Charlie took rejection badly.
He probably said it in a higher voice than that.
Yes. And it was like that he did. He stared at the camera. Yes,
normally I would. I've got a bit of a sore throat at the moment, so normally I would do my Neil Young impression, which is worth hearing. But sadly, I can't. I'm kind of in a low register. So
yes, because you managed to put Morrissey, Adolf Hitler, and Charles Manson in the same sort of little group, didn't you? At one stage,
probably. Yeah. Well, I think that's. Well, I mean, I'm not. I don't know about. Did I say about Morrissey? I'm not sure. Careful lawyers here.
I think you just said that. I can't remember. There was something about them either having sex or not having sex. I can't remember.
Oh, I don't know. I'd be without reading what my carefully legally read book said. I'd be loathed to just ad lib on that one.
I just thought it was quite, you know, quite a nice little piece, because being somebody who grew up loving the Smiths, it was always one of those interesting sort of experiences that in later life you have to sort of navigate what some of your heroes got up to. Oh, this is it. Everyone wants to be loved, with a few rare exceptions. Charles Manson, Hitler, Morrissey, everyone wants to get laid, apart from, perhaps with a few exceptions, Hitler and Morrissey.
Yeah, that's okay. I think we can say that, yeah.
So I thought, so going back to that point that I made, I sort of realised why I liked the book was that I could tell that you absolutely love the subject, and you didn't have to go and revise a female artist or a black artist to then put them in. And I think that's what makes nerdy people like me enjoy books like this, because it's so kind of, you know... Yes,
it's what they now call a deep dive. It's all completely sincere. These are sincerely held beliefs. I think you shoot from the hip. That's fine, you know. I shoot from the hip unapologetically.
Yes. So after your latest, just on the music front, you did your album with Peter. What have you got next lined up?
I'm recording another album with Peter in August. We were due to do it a bit sooner, but our drummer Linda has had to have some major surgery on her shoulder. Get well soon, Linda. It's more of a group thing now, even though it's like myself and Peter are names on it, but it's kind of. Because we've done two tours now, so we're kind of a good live band. We want to record in the studio for the first time. We haven't done that before. So I'm heading over to Seattle in October to record. It'll be the first time we've been in a room to record together, so that'd be good.
God, that's fantastic. And, yes, any other exhibitions? Because I know you're an artist as well, aren't you?
Yeah, not as yet. I'd like to. I mean, I paint all the time, but I'd like to show some paintings maybe sometime next year, end of next year.
Yes, well, it'd be fantastic.
Squeezing it all in, it's a lot of stuff to do.
It is the stuff, and this comes out now, doesn't it? The book.
I think it's in about 2 weeks. I think something like that.
2 weeks. And do you have a book tour? Yeah. Have you got a book tour lined up?
I'm doing some reading actually. I'm doing. Three of the rock and roll book club thingies, and I'm doing. There's a book launch at Rough Trade West, and another kind of book launchy thing, I think, in at Resident in Brighton. Then I'm going over to Belfast to do their Cathedral Arts Festival in May.
Blimey, that's going to be fantastic. I hope you have a great time. I mean, it's a great book, and yes. You. Well, it's been good, and I'd love also reading books where you just have to go and Google something and then go and listen to some other artist that you haven't quite sort of got hold of in life. So but yes. Anyway, look, Luke, thank you ever so much. This has been amazing, and all the best. And I can always, yes, I'll pass this on to whoever. Okay. Oh, it's Ben, wasn't it? Ben, that's the man.
Ben's the man,
The man. Anyway, Luke, have a lovely evening. Thanks again, Luke.
Thank you, David. Lovely to see you. Bye-bye.
And that is the end of the interview. You probably could gather that. A massive thanks and thank you to Luke Haynes for giving me the time. Talking about the book Freaks Out, which has come out on 9/8 Books, which is a very groovy publishing company at the moment. Hopefully continue as well. But anyway, Weirdos, Misfits and Deviants, The Rise and Fall of Righteous Rock and Roll. And also, this is the C86 Show, David Eastall. If you want to contact me, you can on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Just do C86 Show for some reason. And also, all these interviews have been archived on Spotify, iTunes, Podbean. Have a great week. Stay safe.